Hello, everybody. I'm Michel Nashan of Wholesome Wave, and I'm the guest editor this week on foodrepublic.com. So log in to the political section of Food Republic for fun, facts, great meaty stuff, everything delicious, everything real, everything ready to go. Foodrepublic.com. Thanks, Heritage Radio Network.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Boys, I'm mellow as a honeydew. Yeah.
That cat is high. Look that look in his eye. Oh, man, he's high. Yes, higher than a kite.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. In the studio today, we have the lovely Jordana Rothman, food and drinks editor at Time Out New York, also contributing writer for other publications from time to time, and just a lovely, lovely person who is extremely into the cocktail scene. Welcome to the show, Jordana.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm glad that we finally got you on the show. We just entered a new year. Lots of exciting things are happening. And one of the things I like most about Time Out New York is that you cover a lot of, I mean, it's a weekly publication, which is great. So you can actually like be like on it, you know, as far as like the cocktail trends and like spirits trends and different ingredients and techniques and everything. And it's always fascinating to me, like, because, you know, obviously, like, with the New York Times, you've got, like, once a week, maybe twice a week, you know, Wednesday and Sunday, where cocktails are actually covered. So it's just a cool thing. It's like, you know, you never get bored with it, right?
Well, I mean, I will say that Time Out New York is increasingly, you know, it's a weekly publication, but it really has a daily pace to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's as much a matter of serving our reader as it is just, like, that's the pace of New York. And specifically to the cocktail and bar scene, I mean, there was a time when I was really interested in writing about cocktails and bars, and I was going to like the same experts time and time again. I mean, it was, you know, Julie Reiner and Sasha Petrosky, and they just had to be in every single story that I wrote. And now there's just so many bars and so many people involved in the scene that, you know, it's actually kind of hard to keep up with. We manage, but it's just this really, it's just taken a really interesting turn and evolved in a really fascinating and exciting way over the past like 2 years, I would say. Exploded.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I like what you're saying about that too, because when you read some of these like certain feature articles on like say a spirit or a certain ingredient, and they reference like some guy in, like, you know, St. Louis or, you know, Topeka, Kansas.
Well, for us, what we try to do, I mean, definitely, like, the cocktail coverage in Time Out, you know, stems a lot from my own personal interest. And, you know, I really try to be, as much as I can, you know, a fixture on the scene and just, you know, really take a look at what's going on. And for us, I think, you know, our readers are primarily interested in going out to bars and sort of, like, knowing the faces and, like, the terms and all of that. But I think they're also kind of interested, as you say, in like the spirits and techniques and stuff. They maybe want to try things at home. They maybe want to outfit their home bars. They want to kind of, you know, bring a little bit of what they see, you know, out in the field into their own homes, which is super cool. And I think, as is the case at most publications and just in general, like, people are just increasingly educated and engaged and excited about this kind of stuff. And I'm sure, you know, you must see it across the bar all the time. Like, people are asking you questions probably that 2 years ago, like, you never would have gotten, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of that comes with, you know, digging deeper into the history and figuring out like different ingredients that you can make on your own. And then all of a sudden, like, somebody starts producing that like liqueur or spirit that you couldn't get for 100 years.
Right.
So with that love of like the classicism of these cocktails and the history, it only goes so far if you don't have the right equipment and the right ingredients. But now it's just such an exciting time. I probably talk about it too much, but it's like, yeah, I mean, like,
you probably do.
Probably. I mean, I do once weekly radio show. I don't write about it. I talk about it.
Right.
You know, a lot of times too, there are certain people who have, customers of mine who have come in and they're like making their own like syrups and liqueurs and bitters. And that to me is amazing. You know, people, most bartenders weren't even doing that a few years ago.
Right.
And then you've got, people are just interested, enthusiastic about it, coming into your bar and
it's like
kind of
being,
blowing you
it's
away.
Like working in hip hop or something and having everybody showing you their mixtapes. Like, everyone comes out to you. I mean, that's interesting too. You must see, I think back to maybe the aha moment that I had with cocktails when I was I want to know more about this, which I don't know if you want to hear about
yeah,
it, but,
you.
So I was already sort of interested in writing, stories here and there, but I don't think I was handling it with I didn't have quite the right handle on it. I just sort of thought that it was this kind of fringy hipster thing that was happening. And, this is years ago, obviously. And I didn't really think about it in terms of this alchemy and this really interesting stuff that was happening. So I did a story about, I wanted to do a sort of bartender mafia story. This is years ago. Basically the story that I ended up doing in Time Out New York about last spring, which was the State of the New York Cocktail issue where I profiled all the different bartenders. And I wanted to do this years ago. And again, there were not a lot of bartenders that were working on this level at the time. So we sort of thought it over internally and we ended up doing this story that was about bartender fashion. I'm sure because it became this ridiculous point of contention for this person. But it was Toby Maloney, who is a very dear person. And I had him come in and show off his gear, his bag, and his, what he was, shirt stays and all of that. And that was just sort of the take that we took as how we addressed it at the time. And again, not quite the right handle on it. But he was one of the first people that I met in the scene, seriously. And when I was in Chicago, shortly after that, I called him and I was I'm in Chicago, can I come by your bar? And I went right before rehearsal dinner for a wedding, which incidentally was a awful idea because I showed up at this rehearsal dinner, completely hammered. But he basically, took me to the Violet Hour and just sort of showed me through some things that I had absolutely never encountered before, never thought about the breadth of what was possible in cocktails, never thought intellectually about really what was going on in the glass. And he, as you know, has an exceptional palate and is a really skilled guy. And he just, that was really a turning point for me.
Cool.
Really,
do you remember the one of the drinks that you had while you were there?
One of the first drinks I had there was a New York sour, which he did with instead of the claret snap, he did a rosé float.
Oh,
and he
cool.
served it in a little milk glass.
Nice.
A diner style milk glass. And I, when he put it in front of me and he did that final flourish, it went from looking like milk to looking like strawberry milk. And I was probably pretty far gone at this point already, but I just had such a childish, whimsical reaction to this. I just thought it was so incredible and beautiful, and the color was just cascading down the side of the glass, and I was just so
nice.
Totally overwhelmed by it. And since then I hope that I think that I've really honed my understanding of the scene, certainly my palate a lot, and just grown so much, and I've been able to kind of put my stamp on it a little bit, and I don't know, just get excited and get to know the people behind it, because it's such a fascinating and just rich, rich scene.
It is, actually. I mean, it's so deep, too, nowadays. We were talking about before the show about, Tales of the Cocktail. Now there's Portland Cocktail Week.
Right.
There's the Manhattan Cocktail Classic.
Right.
And, again, you're seeing people all over the country and all over the world that are just, digging really deep into
right.
it. And, there was a couple of years ago when that whole world was getting some bad press because it seemed like a
precious
fad.
And
even not just a fad, almost like too exclusive, too cool for anyone else
right.
to be part of it, which is not true,
Well,
yeah, everyone, it's there. Okay.
I mean, it's on its way out of that, but it's still, that's a big hurdle, I think, for a lot of people to get into it.
And I think there were a lot of bartenders a few years ago that they probably felt they were cooler than everyone else because they knew how to make
Ramos
Ramos and Fizz. And then it got to a point where they got really bummed out when people would order them because
right
it was dude, this was the drink you were pushing a year ago and now you don't want to shake this for 12 minutes, even though you don't really have to shake a Ramos for 12 minutes.
Well, to that point, I mean, first of all, just to go back to this sort of Toby. So at that juncture, he fed me Chinar for the first time, which I was like disgusted by at the time, and now I've like really grown towards it because it's like, I think it's kind of like when you are a hooker who's done everything, like suddenly nothing really has like that edge anymore. So like I've tasted so many things that now, like, you know, a drier thing like Chinar.
Jack, I think that's the quote.
I can deal with it now because, you know, I've tasted so much and I think that my palate has tended towards a drier angle, and so I think has much of New York. And to your point about people sort of digging into it, like suddenly people have these like fresh, interesting palates, and like they want to taste funky stuff, and yeah, they want to, you know, they want to like dig into it, which, yeah, is so cool. You know, this is a city that a few years ago would be completely content with their cosmopolitans, and
right,
you know,
a lot of them still are.
Sure.
You know, it's not like it's completely changed, mm-hmm, or revolutionized the scene at all, but it's definitely growing and getting, right, better. Yeah, and you know, you were in Chicago, did you have Malort?
No.
Don't go there.
Not yet. I'm not there yet.
I don't know. To each their own, but that's a big Chicago bitters, and it's, I'll just stop there because some people would be offended.
Oh,
if
no.
I made fun of it.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, this is
maybe
quite
I'm
a few
not
years
there
ago
yet
at this point. So, yeah. I don't know. I mean, honestly, I think that my palate is probably still evolving. And, you know, there are things that is distasteful to me now that maybe I'll, you know, learn to love in the future. I don't know.
Yeah.
But to your point about, you know, the accessibility of cocktail lounges and cocktails in general, I mean, that's something that's really important to what I do at Time Out. Like, I'm really committed, not just in cocktails, but across the board, to, like, finding access points for my reader who, you know, might be buying Time Out for, like, the music listings,
yeah,
you know, or, you know, and then they get into the food and they're like, whoa, this is cool. Or they buy it, you know, for food and drink. But whatever it is, like, I want to find ways for people to get excited about the stuff that I'm excited about. And that's always really been sort of, like, a touchstone of what I do and why I do it. And I remember, you know, not too long ago, someone was telling me a story, and I'll leave names out and venues out because I don't want to incriminate anyone, but someone was telling me a story about being at a cocktail bar, and this is actually a guest, not a bartender, but it was a guest who is sort of like a cocktail nerd kind of thing. And the guest, this other guest came in and ordered a Long Island iced tea. And look, like, we all know that's, I mean, way to like mark yourself as a noob and have, yeah, no idea where you are. Like, of course, you know, like, of course it's like an awful kind of drink, but look, the dude obviously does not know that he's like making a faux pas. So just make him feel comfortable or guide him in the direction of something that might, you know, suit.
Oh, if you like that, you might like this.
Exactly. That kind of thing. And that's like so important. And that's how you recruit people and get people excited about the cocktail movement, not by making them feel like assholes. And so this guest, you know, was like, they were like mocking him to his face, and they were wanted to pour the bar mat out into a cocktail glass and that kind of thing.
Oh my God.
And yes, it's all like funny banter that we can have behind the scenes and all that. But like, let's just be honest and like, look, this is my opinion that, you know, in order for it to really gain traction and stick around, you need bodies. Like, you need, yeah, people who are going to believe in what we're all doing and, you know, taste the good cocktail and say, I'm not going back to swill now. You know, yeah, I've had this experience and now, you know, I'm going to move forward. A similar, you know, mirroring like the slow food movement where, you know, once you have a humanely raised, locally raised, you know, piece of pork, yeah, you don't want to eat factory farm pork anymore because it doesn't taste good.
Yeah.
You know, and you need people, you need warm bodies to make that happen and really like reach the tipping point. And I think that a lot of that has to do with attitude and accessibility and just like making the guests feel comfortable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No. Well put, Jordana. You know what? We're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, I would like to talk a little bit more about the other part of your job as it pertains to the drinks. Let's talk about some food at some of the cocktail bars. All right, back in a moment.
Today's episode of The Speakeasy was brought to you by White Oak Pastures. White Oak Pastures cattle are raised in a manner that has stood the test of time. It begins with southern sunshine, unpolluted country air, and fertile coastal soil. The cattle are allowed to roam the pastures and graze freely on sweet native grasses all of their lives. For more information, go to whiteoakpastures.com.
You know the roof is leaking and the rain is falling through.
Drip, drip, drippity drop.
And we're back. You're listening to The Speakeasy. In the studio today, we have Jordana Rothman, food and drinks editor at Time Out New York. And we were just talking about the current state of the New York cocktail scene. And we left off talking a little bit about food. And I think so many cocktail bars, I mean, first of all, in New York City, it's really hard to get a liquor license without having some sort of food in your bar. And a lot of these places have, like, Death & Company, Myowell, Lani Kai, they have amazing food, but they don't really get as much press for it, you know?
Well, I certainly think, from a principal perspective, like, eating is a part of drinking.
Well, yeah,
like,
if you're
drinking smartly, then you're also eating so that you're not, you know, just a complete mess at the end of the night. So certainly, like, I love it when a cocktail bar is not just providing some, like, sponge for the booze,
right,
but is also actually, like, putting some attention into it. You know, like, that said, I think that, you know, I personally don't go to the cocktail bar for dinner, but I love when there's good food there.
Yeah.
Personally, I think, like, Criff Dogs PT is, like, the ideal model.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, I do want a hot dog. I want a fucking hot dog. Like,
yeah,
that's
those
like,
and those tater tots are amazing.
I want a hot dog and tater tots. And I love, like, the partnerships that they do with chefs. Like, they have you know, the Wiley dog, and they had, like, the Van Dog when Philip Kirshen Clark was still at Van Dog. So I love that kind of thing. And I agree. I mean, I think, you know, employees only, like Julia Jaksik, you know, is really, really talented. She does some interesting stuff. They're like bone marrow poppers and things like that. And as you say, Death & Company, I mean, I haven't eaten a huge amount at Death & Company, but, you know, they hit the marks, you know, like they have oysters. That's like perfect cocktail food, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. How do you feel about, like, cocktail food pairings? What's your...
Well, you know, I think things have changed a lot over the, like, well, obviously they have changed a lot over the past few years, but whereas it was kind of an afterthought and a means for getting your liquor license and opening up your bar and then just go in balls to the wall with your drinks and kind of leaving the kitchen alone, it's like having, like, halogen, like, track lighting in, like, a, like, classic bar room, you know? It's like, you're kind of screwing it up. You're, like, you're leaving out one, like, really important portion of your establishment. Like, your lighting. Mm-hmm. That's really important.
Yeah, but I feel like...
It's something that you can utilize in your establishment.
I feel like the key is that you're at the cocktail bar. Like, you have to pay attention to how people use your establishment. And, like, if they're primarily using your establishment to, like, come after dinner and have drinks or, you know, like, start their night off with drinks or whatever it may be, give them food. But, like, don't try to do everything. Just like a restaurant shouldn't try to do everything.
Small,
like,
plates or...
Do it, like, think smartly. How do you eat when you're drinking? Like, I feel like there's a tendency to kind of, like, no one wants a steak.
No, you want, like, steak tartare, maybe.
Right. I mean, and then, you know, the cocktail and food pairing thing, like, I'm still on the fence about it. Like, there's a place, there's the Beagle in the East Village that I think they do excellent cocktails, and I love their style of food. I just think it's really sweet and just really charming, and, you know, I really like it there. But they do these pairing boards, which are, like, a little bit of food and, like, you know, either, like, maybe some sherry or whatever it may be, and, like, doesn't quite coalesce for me because it's just, it's so high proof. It's like, it just obliterates, you know, a cocktail just kind of robs the nuance of the food a little bit. But, like, there are some pairings that make sense, I think.
Yeah, I mean, well, you think about, like, Mexican food and, like, tequila drinks like Myowell, you know, with, like, mezcal and tequila. They do, I mean, they pair really well together. You think, like, even before, like we're saying, like Lani Kai, you know, Polynesian food with Polynesian and like, tiki drinks works so well. And, you know, you get a poo-poo platter.
Right.
It's communal. You're not eating a whole lot, and it's small bites, you know.
Right.
So it just makes
sense. I think that works really well, and I also think, you know, the places that you mentioned, like, you know, My World, you know, does it super, super well. Like, they do snacks. They do things that people want to eat when they're drinking, you know, tequila and mezcal. On the other hand, you know, Lani Kai, I also think they do it, so I love a poo-poo platter, and also, you know, they do have a bit of, like, a dinner, like, earlier crowd, and they, you know, they invested in that. They got themselves a new chef, which is, I think, very smart for the neighborhood, you know? I think it's always very important that you not just sort of open a cocktail bar or any kind of bar, any venue for that matter, that just, you know, hits certain notes and follows, like, a certain formula, but that you actually pay attention to your kind of clientele, what you want out of your clientele, like, where you want to sort of bring them on the journey of your place and where you are, what you're providing for the neighborhood, all of that. Like, that's very, I think the best places, the places that last, like, really take that to heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, for instance, what we were talking about on the break, you know, the Bourgeois Pig Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Small place. They're doing small plates, and they're, like, keeping it really neighborhood.
Yeah.
They've got, you know, fondue and, like, charcuterie and some raw bar stuff. And it's kind of, like, it's the right kind of food.
Yeah.
And also, like, they're doing Fernet bottle service, which is great.
Which you love.
So that's really taking care of the neighborhood, like,
I mean,
industry folk after work.
The Bourgeois Pig, I've actually only come by for family and friends, but I'm really excited about it, not the least of which because I actually live, like, two blocks away from there.
Right.
But Frankie, first of all, is, like, a completely lovely person, but he's a real thinker, you know, like, I think he represents a part of this industry that is super exciting because, again, he's not just hitting these, like, benchmark notes. He really understands how to, like, massage a cocktail list and really, I mean, that, you know, he does like a sort of continental spirits and, like, he does a really interesting take on a Mai Tai. That, I can just see the work. Like, I can see the ditch digging and what he's done, and I can just see, like, I can imagine him, like, testing and testing and tasting and all of that. And it really comes through in what he does, and I think that's so special. Like, you know, and it's the same thing at Prime Meats and, you know, with what you do. Like, what was the was it Four Horsemen, that drink?
Oh, I, no.
No? There was a drink that was, well.
What was it?
Oh,
what
gosh,
did it have
no.
in it?
Well, now I'm totally blanking on it, but, you know, but I think my point is that when you can spot that finesse and it's really about, as much about matching the vibe of the place and really, like, hinging on some, like, thematic richness, you know, like, Frankie is doing that really well at Bourgeois Pig, and I just, you know, I love to see that. I love to see a place that isn't just sort of, like, cranking out Sazeracs and, you know, Manhattan. It's not that there's anything wrong with those drinks. They're fantastic, but...
Yeah.
I think the next level for us is to kind of put that personal mark on it, you know, put a thematic mark on it, do something that, you know, really has an identity and is idiosyncratic and personal.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, with that being said, with those classics, you know, and obviously we want to be inventive and innovative, but it's you know, with so many cocktail bars opening up, there aren't enough bartenders that know what they're doing to, like, fill them up.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of, like newbies, and that's great. It's cool that there are platforms for them to stand on, you know, and work these kinds of cocktails. But really, what happens with those, like, when you say about, like, the Sazerac or an Old Fashioned, there's so many people out there who don't know how to make just... the classics, you
sure
know,
I mean, really... it's like the mother sauces.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
so it takes, you know, you can't just, like, overnight become, you know, like, the greatest mixologist. And, you know, with Frankie, you know, he's been doing it for a really long time,
and he's a sommelier,
and he's also a certified sommelier.
Yeah
totally. So yeah, he's a super taster, as they call it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I mean, I agree, and I think that another... The cocktail business, revivalist cocktail business, is very, I want to say young, although that seems like not the right thing to say, given that it is so ancient. But because of Prohibition, like, we lost so much of the culture. We exported so much of the culture and so much of the talent, and it's really just rebuilding. You know, of course, like, starting with Dale DeGroff and up through the present, you know, with all of the new faces and, you know. I think that a big part of the future with regards to like sort of teaching those classics and making sure is sort of like building, you know, just like kitchens have an apprenticeship sort of system where, you know, people are actually taking the time to learn the basics before and be educated before they sort of go off
the bar and, back.
Right. Well, I did the beverage alcohol resource last fall, which was really interesting.
You did the 5-day one, right?
Wow. I did. Yeah. It was really interesting. Like, you know, I tend to think in terms of like the final product, like the cocktail, but this is, you know, obviously just about the spirits and distillation and just like this ancient stuff, like this ancient, you know, and like, I think it's really fascinating how they managed to sort of like codify this information. Like when I became a food writer, no one sat me down and was like, here's how you taste food. And like, here are flavors to look for in food. Like it just sort of, you know, I built off of my experience of eating whatever the hell, like growing up, you know, and like just slowly like ate and tasted more and was able to kind of like build this Rolodex of flavor in my mind. And I think at whether you do it at bar, whether you just do it because you're a taster, you know, whatever it is, like you think that's something that you do. You sort of like build this like this codified structure.
That was Steve Olson saying that, right?
I don't know if he said that, but
because when I went, I didn't do the 5-day, but I did the 1-day. But he was talking about basically like imagining like a giant spreadsheet,
right?
Or in a way like you like a giant flow chart of flavors and connecting them together, and you know, like you were saying, you know, with taking all those spirits into consideration, you taste through like. It was like 180 different spirits over 5 days or something like that.
I think like more. Like something insane like that. It was just so, Jesus, it was like palate fatigue by the middle of the week.
Yeah.
I mean, it's intense, man. It's like 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And yeah. And like the cool thing about that though, is like you were saying, you're like keeping that in the flavor profiles in your Rolodex for these different spirits is like that really, it's so important for coming up with a cocktail. Like, there was a Tanqueray event that Brian Miller held last year, and they took Tanqueray, Beefeater, and Plymouth, which are the typical, like, that's the big three of, like, cocktail bars, and made, you know, a round of drinks with those three. You know, like, they did three, like, Last Words and three Gimlets, three martinis, three French 75s, you know, each with a different gin, and it's so...
Did you taste them blind?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was crazy. I mean, like, but I had done all the tasting, like, when I was working at Linnell's. So I had that already in my Rolodex, you know? So I got most of them right. But it was really amazing to see how, like, you know, with even with Plymouth, it's like the smooth gin.
Right.
It was actually hot in some of the drinks, like in the Negroni, for one. And then the Beefeater, which you would think was going to be, like, the biggest one.
Right.
Was really smooth.
Well, removing, like, the, you know, brand loyalty is so... important. I mean, blind tasting is so incredibly important. I mean, when you just like when you taste things side by side, you get to sense the nuance of all of them, and you also just get a sense of like what instinctually your palate likes.
Yeah.
You know, like of course we all, you know, think about Plymouth and, you know, Beefeater and Tanqueray, but taste them blind, you know, decide for yourself really, really what works for you.
Absolutely.
And then you know what to call for. I mean, it's fascinating, like things that I thought, you know, I would love. You know, when you taste them blind, they're just gluey and chewy and, you know, weird and just not tight, you know? It's a fascinating program. I mean, like, there was a kid that was... So there was a kid in our bar program who was, like, a beverage director for TGI Fridays. And I was like, or something like chili, like one of those. And I was like, dude, you are the most important person in the room. Because all these... This is, like, the choir. And he's the guy that's going to, like, take it out.
Yeah.
Of, like, the nerdy cocktail circles and, like, I don't know, maybe change the beverage program at TGI Fridays or something. Like, that's crazy. That guy's important, right?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Think about it in those terms of, like, exporting the good gospel and then, you know, you've got something.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Anything that you're excited about coming up in the new year? Any new openings or places that have opened?
Well, I'm really... I've heard some rumblings about Dave Arnold... and some he has maybe it's called Dax and Booker or something. He's doing like I feel like I'm talking from Twitter right now, but there's some rumblings of like something like that.
I don't know, have you heard anything like that?
You know, Dave Arnold has this like
Jack just confirmed that. She doesn't have her headphones on.
Yeah, no, I'm sure from the back of my head that's a, so he's, you know, obviously been a part of the cocktail business in an interesting way for several years. I mean, he does his hot poker things and he's really into like breaking down the science of drinks, right, and all of that. So I'm really interested to see what he could bring to it on an official level. Like, Dave Ronald is, you know, does not bullshit. Like, he does not, you know, like, care about like what things are supposed to, what's good or bad. Like, he just wants, he's down to like the sort of nitty gritty scientific, this is how this works and this is maybe why you like it and why, you know, he's just, have you seen any of his like,
oh yeah,
RotoVap demonstrations and stuff? Like, totally absolutely fascinating. Yeah,
I had the pleasure of working an event with him at the Museum of Food and Drink fundraiser, and
oh yeah,
it was
sure,
just amazing experience. Yeah, amazing guy.
I mean, I want to see that come to fruition. That's really, the Museum of Food and Drink will be incredibly, I mean, I could see it being something that becomes, you know, like a real, I don't know, like a Smithsonian for our culture in New York. I don't know. I would love to see that come to fruition. I would love there to be like a tangible part of it, like a cocktail bar or restaurant that serves incredible cocktails and just like not only gathers the history of food and drink in New York, but contributes to it as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Jordana, thank you so much for coming on to the show today.
Thank you.
You're lovely. I always have a great time when I see you. We always have a great conversation, and you'll have to come back sometime.
I would love to. Thank you very much.
Awesome. All right. That's it for the Speakeasy today. Tune in next week, where my guest will be Nicholas Jarrett, and we're going to taste some vintage spirits next to the modern version. It should be really interesting. Tune in. We'll see you then. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. Yes, he's high. Man, he's high.